My name is Victor Furman. Some call me The Voice. I've always been fascinated with human nature, spirituality, science, and the crossroads at which they meet. Join me now and we will explore these topics and so much more with fascinating guests, authors, and experts who will guide us to Destination Unlimited. When we think of the roots of Western civilization, our minds go to ancient Greece and the great philosophers like Pythagoras, Plato, and Socrates. The question arises, were their ideas and concepts original and unique to them, or were they inspired by others, other cultures, and other civilizations? What would you think if you were told that there were ashrams in Europe 2,500 years ago? Or that many of the famous Greek philosophers studied in India and were directly influenced by the great yogic traditions? My guest this week, Linda Johnson, says there is an impressive historical evidence for this, and that Western tradition bears a striking resemblance to Eastern spirituality. Linda Johnson is a longtime student of religious philosophy. She holds degrees in Eastern and Western psychology and has postgraduate training in theology and Sanskrit. She's the award-winning author of 8 books, including Daughters of the Goddess, The Women Saints of India, and The Complete Idiot's Guide to Hinduism. Hundreds of her articles have appeared in Yoga International, Yoga Journal, and other publications. She joins us this evening to discuss her new book, Lost Masters, Rediscovering the Mysticism of the Ancient Greek Philosophers. Please join me in welcoming Linda Johnson. Good evening, Linda.
Thank you so much for having me on to talk about my favorite subject in the world.
Well, we're going to share a lot tonight, a lot that's going to be an eye-opener for many of us, because I'll be frank with you, a lot of the stuff that I learned in your book, I didn't know, and I was kind of pleasantly surprised to discover. So let's make that discovery together for our listeners. So, Linda, we're peers. We grew up in the 60s and 70s, a time when our generation was searching for a deeper meaning in life, a better understanding of the human condition, and a more deep and meaningful connection to each other and the universe. Please share with our listeners your early path and how it led to the study of Indian religion and mysticism.
Well, you know, I actually think the Hindus sum it up perfectly when they say there are 4 legitimate goals in life, you know, prosperity, pleasure, meaningful work, and spiritual growth. You know, in our culture, we're given the impression that if you're interested in spirituality, you know, you're superstitious or irrational, or maybe you're just a plain so-called New Age flake. You know, but, you know, in my opinion, and I've felt this since I was a child, you know, we're not here just to buy stuff, you know, and to work till we drop and get drunk. You know, we're here to understand what life is about and to achieve some sort of wisdom. And that's what the ancient Greeks were all about, and there's so much we can learn from them. I actually have a very strong Christian background, went to all Christian schools from grade school through postgraduate work. But there was something more that I was looking for, you know, some real, more mystical depth, you know, like the Bible says, be still and know that I am God, but it doesn't teach you how to be still. So I wound up, you know, studying with various yoga masters and shastris and yoginis in India, trying to learn that. And I wrote hundreds and hundreds of magazine articles about my experiences in India and so on. And I wrote 7 books about Eastern spirituality, but I didn't want to repeat myself. So I thought, well, what's a fresh subject? And I started thinking, hey, wait a minute. What did people in the ancient West believe in? Did they have spiritual practices? You know, in the pre-Christian European world, I mean, what did they believe in? And so, like most other people on the planet, I actually thought the ancient Greek philosophers were as relevant to our lives today as bows and arrows.
Now, you share in your writings that you were sitting in your class and your professor in a Jesuit college was teaching about Plato. How did that make you feel?
It was by far the most boring class. I loved college, but that was a boring, boring class. And there was all this material in Plato and other sources that he told you to skip that. That's Oriental contamination of pure Western rationality. So, don't even waste your time looking at that. But when I started doing this research into ancient Greek sources, I went back and looked at the material that my Jesuit professor told me to skip. And that's where I found the juice. I was always told that that the ancient Greek philosophers were the founders of our modern tradition of scientific materialism. But what they tell us about themselves is that they were intensely interested in spirituality. Many of them believed in karma and reincarnation, and a lot of them were vegetarian.
You were going to touch upon those points a little bit later, but why do you think the teaching of philosophy in Western academia became so sterile?
There were two big hits on the ancient traditions and the ancient understanding, the living tradition of mysticism. And the first, I'm saddened to say, was actually my own religious tradition. Christianity, for all the wonderful things about it and for Jesus and all the positive things, there was also this dark side that set out to exterminate all knowledge of these ancient traditions. And then by the time of the European Enlightenment, you had this, and the Renaissance before that, you had this massive reaction against Orthodox religion in Europe. And then things went to the opposite extreme. Then it became very, very materialistic and very, very negative about any sort of spiritual realities and spiritual experiences. And so all this was actively suppressed for centuries and centuries. So really, if you wanted to really experience a really living ancient tradition, you want to study Kabbalah or Sufism or yoga or Buddhism. It's really, really sad.
Now, so all of us in our generation, we went out and whatever our birth, culture, faith, religion might have been, we sort of looked for something else because we weren't feeling that satisfaction or that deep connection, that mystical connection that so many of us yearn for, that definition of to why we were here and what's our purpose on this planet and what's our connection to each other and what's it all really about. So what was your first inkling that there was a connection between the Hellenic philosophy and Eastern teachings?
Well, it was just starting to read this material, and what I found, they're talking about they're studying near-death experiences. They're talking about meditation. They're even talking about, animal rights. I mean, I never heard about any of, I mean, even in my class on the research, I never heard about any of this stuff. But when you go back, not to what the scholars today write about the ancient Greeks, but to what the Greeks themselves wrote, 2,500 years ago, 2,000 years ago, 1,700 years ago, that's where the juice is.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Now, what influence did ancient Egyptian and Persian thought have on the Hellenic philosophers?
It is a myth that the ancient Greeks were these self-educated geniuses who came up with all their insights by themselves. Many of them, Democritus, Plato, Apollonius, Plotinus, they studied in Egypt. Some of them, studied in Syria. Some of them studied, in Turkey. And a few of them actually studied in India. So there was a, we had this idea that these ancient cultures were really just completely disconnected. But there was a lot of communication going on between these traditions. And fortunately for us, some of it was written down, and we still have evidence of it.
And how far back do you think this exchange of information really goes? Because I think today even archaeologists are finding older civilizations that are just coming to light that are much older than we've ever considered. And some of their thought and their practices may have been something that was handed down even through the Egyptians and the Persians.
I mean, you and I, you must be like telepathically in contact with me. I say, you know, kind of tongue-in-cheek, but there's some truth in it. I absolutely believe that. You know, even these attempts to say that the ancient Vedic tradition was only went back to like 1200 BC, and now all the archaeological evidence, the DNA evidence, you know, the oral traditions of both North India and South India, you know, it's all contradicting it and showing how ancient the Indian tradition was. The Vedas were probably originally composed around 5,000 years ago, and they refer to masters who were ancient to them in their time. So these are really, really old traditions.
Absolutely, and something that we have to look into deeper to find the true roots and the true sources. You know, when you talk about Plato and Atlantis, what was he talking about? Where was that civilization? And going back into these antiquities that we're just beginning to scratch the surface of that existed on this planet.
Yes, it's possible that he was making that up, but he was making it up based on their own archaeological discoveries in those days, and they knew of various cities and that had actually been flooded, and knew of ancient cultures, including the more ancient Greek culture, that had been wiped out, you know, centuries before. And then many of them traveled to Egypt where they were taught, you know, as Plato says, you know, hey, this stuff goes back way, way, way far. So I'm not completely sure whether I believe that Atlantis really existed exactly as Plato described it. But he does say that there were ancient cultures who were wiped out by fire and others who were wiped out by floods. And the more archaeological research we're doing, the more we're digging, the more we're finding, Plato was right.
My guest is Linda Johnson. Her new book, Lost Masters, Rediscovering the Mysticism of the Ancient Greek Philosophers. And we'll be back with Linda after these messages on the Om Times Radio Network.
Om Times Magazine is one of the leading online content providers of positivity, wellness, and personal empowerment. A philanthropic organization, their net proceeds are funneled to support worldwide charity initiatives via Humanity Healing International. Through their commitment to creating community and providing conscious content, they aspire to uplift humanity on a global scale. Om Times, co-creating a more conscious lifestyle.
Hi, this is Sylvia Henderson, intuitive life coach and energy healer. Are you ready to elevate and rise way above your normal? Be sure to listen to my show, Intuitive Transformations, on Om Times Radio, Sunday evenings at 9 p.m. Eastern. Get the inspiration you need to transform your life.
Hello, this is Alec Baldwin for Save the Manatee Club. In an animated TV show, I was the voice of a marine biologist dedicated to saving Florida's imperiled manatees. It was a lot of fun, but there's a serious side, too. Tragically, many of these gentle marine mammals suffer injuries or die from boat strikes, and their habitat is being lost. Manatees need your help. Please call 1-800-432-JOIN or visit www.savethemanatee.org.
I didn't know it would be so hard. It's easier to heal others than to heal myself.
If you or someone you know has a drug or alcohol problem, you are not alone.
Recovery was the hardest job I ever had, and the most important.
For information and treatment referral, call 1-800-662-HELP. Brought to you by the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services.
And we're back on Destination Unlimited. My guest this evening is Linda Johnson. She's author of the new book, Lost Masters, Rediscovering the Mysticism of the Ancient Greek Philosophers. So we were talking a little bit about some of these wonderful philosophers and the beliefs that they actually had that may have been predicated on their exposure to Eastern philosophy. So let's talk about Pythagoras in particular. Pythagoras believed in reincarnation, and according to your book, founded an ashram in Italy. That's amazing. Please tell us about that.
Pythagoras, this is the guy who invented the theorem that we learned about in math class when we were kids. And you're right, Victor, he actually founded a hugely successful spiritual community in Italy. This was around 600 BC. His followers meditated, they ate no meat, they drank no alcohol, they worked out, they practiced music therapy, and they tried to reach a state of enlightenment. Pythagoras actually spent decades studying with spiritual masters in Egypt and Syria and Persia, and possibly, according to one ancient source, with Hindu Brahmins. And get this. His first teacher was Thales. Now, this is the very same Thales that I learned in grade school was the father of Western science. Mm-hmm. And it was Thales who encouraged him to go to Egypt, because Thales himself had studied with the priest there. I hope people won't get the impression that I'm saying that everything that they learned they got from India, because there were many great spiritual traditions at that time, and they were learning from the Chaldeans, they were learning from the Palestinian masters, but Pythagoras also studied with them, according to some ancient sources, but some of them actually made it to India. And the thing is, what's so startling is that what these teachers here at one end of the Indo-European world, you know, the Greco-Roman universe, and then at the other end of the Indo-European world, you know, India, they're teaching very much the same thing. That to me was really, really startling. And I think this is part of this is also due to the fact that they're studying spiritual science. They're really using their reason and they're using their intuitive powers to understand spiritual science. So whether or not they were in direct contact with other cultures, they're discovering the same fundamental truths. You know, they're all practicing meditation. You know, they're all doing the equivalent of yoga practice or even tantric practice as it's known in India today. India is special because India is the one culture where all this stuff has been preserved intact for all these thousands of years, where you can still go and still be taught in the parampara, you know, in the lineages going back thousands of years. In ancient Greece, they talked of the golden chain, you know, the chain of masters who were passing on the spiritual knowledge. And then around the late 5th, early 6th, century, this was completely eradicated. But, you know, it's time to reconnect with that chain of knowledge that was preserved not just in India, but that was practiced and was a living spirituality of our own ancestors, at least for those of us whose ancestors came from Europe or from Northern Africa.
Now, let's talk a little bit more about Pythagoras and his belief in reincarnation. How did he pursue that?
He actually believed that his students said that he remembered his previous incarnations going back for lifetimes and lifetimes, because in the distant past he had worshipped Hermes, the Greek god. And Hermes appeared to him and said, you know, what would you like? And of course he said, well, make me immortal. And Hermes said, you know, I can't give you that. I can't give you something I don't have myself, because at the end of the world cycle, even the gods pass away. So ask for something else. So Pythagoras, in his previous life, asked for, let me not lose my awareness during the after-death state, and let me in every incarnation remember who I was in the past. And his disciples claimed that one of the reasons he was so profoundly wise and insightful was because he hadn't forgotten like the rest of us do. He remembered who he was. And then he went and studied with even more teachers in different cultures. His tradition of Pythagoreanism influenced so many masters. For example, Empedocles. He was the guy that we were told in grade school was the first Greek to teach that matter is made of elements. So that's what we heard about Empedocles. But Empedocles was also a physician. But his main interest, according to the ancient sources, was, quote, curing souls. He was a hugely popular public speaker, we're told. And so everywhere he went, you know, huge crowds would gather and hear him speak. And what would he tell them to do? So the sources tell us he told people to meditate. And I actually jotted down an actual quote that has survived among the fragments of Empedocles. So let me tell you in his own words what he was advising people. He said, "You must plunge beneath your crowded thoughts and calmly contemplate higher realities with pure focused attention. Then a state of tranquility will remain with you throughout your life. But if instead you direct your attention to the trivial things most people obsess about, the silly nonsense that dulls their mind, then all you'll get are physical things that you'll just lose anyway." And Victor, you know, you were just talking about reincarnation. Let me tell you what Empedocles said about reincarnation. He said, "Souls who through their own error fall under the power of fear and delusion are forced by eternal law to wander for long cycles, taking birth in mortal bodies, exchanging suffering in one type of body for suffering in another. I'm one of those exiles myself, wandering far from my heavenly source, having mistakenly put my faith in this crazy, violent world." That was Empedocles.
Wow.
And I don't want to spend a lot of time just quoting things, but let me just read you one more that I have here in front of me. Okay, this is Empedocles, one of the founders of the scientific tradition in the West. Here is what Empedocles said about God. He said, "The divine isn't something you see with your eyes or hold in your hands. It doesn't have a face or feet or gender, but is pure consciousness, whose awareness extends throughout the entire cosmos. It is nothing but consciousness in every direction and eternally rejoices in the encircling silence."
Wow.
Now, Victor, today we call this Eastern philosophy. 2,500 years ago, this was Western philosophy.
Amazing. Absolutely,
it is.
Amazing.
It's incredible. They didn't tell us this when they taught us about Empedocles in school.
No, I think we would have spent more time and paid greater attention and perhaps studied it further if we had, you know, been stimulated with all of these thoughts, because these are the thoughts that we sought when we were in school. These are the things that made us turn away from whatever our foundational teachings were to find those that we deemed exotic or Eastern, things that stimulated us and put us in greater touch with the cosmos. So absolutely would have changed our thinking altogether. Just getting back to Pythagoras one more time, because he's one of my heroes, actually.
Oh, okay.
How many lifetimes did he, what was the earliest lifetime that he told his students about? Do you know?
That was the one in which he was a devotee of the deity Hermes. We are not told what year that was, and we are not told specifically how many incarnations they were. If that was written down, you have to remember that, you know, probably 94% or more of ancient writings was lost to time, or was purposely destroyed over the centuries. So we only have fragments left, tragically, of what was written down thousands of years ago.
Now, what other Greek philosophers studied in Egypt that you're aware of?
Pyrrho, and Anaxarchus, and then I have to tell you about Apollonius.
Please.
Most of us think during the first century A.D., obviously the best known spiritual figure in the Roman Empire would have been Jesus. But that's not true. During his own lifetime, Jesus was hardly known at all in the empire. It was like another century or two before he became really his tradition became really well known. The most famous sage in the first century was Apollonius of Tyana. And he actually traveled to India and studied in a Hindu ashram. And records of this have survived. After studying there, everywhere he went after that, Greece, Rome, Spain, Turkey, North Africa, he would tell people about the yogis. He said the yogis were the wisest, the most amazing human beings he had ever met. Now, he later went to Egypt, which, you know, at that time, India and Egypt were the two great spiritual cultures that were known to the Greeks. So he went to Egypt, too, and we're told that he noticed how incredibly similar the Egyptians' esoteric doctrines and practices were to those that he had learned in India. He had this fascinating theory, Victor, that in vast antiquity, a group of teachers from India must have migrated to North Africa and taught this stuff to the Egyptians. Now, let me go on record here and say, I am not saying that's historically true, that actually happened, though it could have. But Apollonius believed it did happen, and he was in a position to know because he studied in both cultures, and he was so blown away by here at the opposite end of the world are these two spiritual cultures that are so similar. Now, of course, as I'm doing all this reading in numerous, numerous ancient texts, so I'm also finding references in very ancient Egyptian king / deity Osiris. Mm-hmm. There's actually a tradition that he went to India. I mean, I couldn't believe it.
And we're gonna pick up on that after the break, but I have to say that my guest this evening is Linda Johnson. She's the author of Lost Masters, Rediscovering the Mysticism of the Ancient Greek Philosophers. And Linda, please tell our listeners where they can get your book and find out more about you and your work.
You can go to Amazon, to BarnesandNoble.com. Support your local bookshop. Go there and order Lost Masters.
Amen.
My website is lostmasters.com. Check it out.
And we'll be back with Linda Johnson and more of this fascinating look at history that was never taught to us in school when we return after these messages from the Om Times Radio Network.
You're listening to OTR FM, part of the IOM Radio Network.
Are you in an interfaith relationship and thinking of getting married? For 18 years, Reverend Lori Sue Brockway has been creating personalized, loving, and romantic ceremonies for couples of all faiths and cultural backgrounds. Reverend Lori Sue's sensitivity to the needs of interfaith couples is reflected in the compassionate and inclusive way she addresses the concerns of parents and families. Reverend Lori Sue is also the author of several best-selling books on interfaith weddings and wedding vows. Selected as one of the top interfaith officiants by New York Magazine, Reverend Lori Sue serves couples in the New York metropolitan area and beyond. Find out more at her website, yourinterfaithwedding.com.
Have you ever wondered how to change your love paradigm? The secret key is finding a love partnership, not just a regular connection. How do you find these? Through conscious relationships. Ascending Hearts Dating is a dating site for people like you that believes in second chances and a different type of spiritual connection. Try Ascending Hearts for free today at ascendinghearts.com and change your love paradigm. Ascending Hearts, the premier dating community for the spiritually awake.
Join me, Maggie Chula, on Mondays at noon Eastern for Mastermind with Maggie. Let's work together in a mastermind. We can resolve life's problems and create goals for the future. Build action steps empowering you to create your life in partnership with your divine source of light, your soul. Manifesting your goals can be simple and easy, so come with your problems and leave with a plan. The Akashic Master Teachers and I are waiting to help you.
And we're back on Destination Unlimited. My guest this evening, Linda Johnson, author of the great new book, Lost Masters, Rediscovering the Mysticism of the Ancient Greek Philosophers. Linda, before the break, we were talking about this knowledge of East and West and finding the Eastern philosophy in the West and having all of these amazing teachers and philosophers gain this information and bring it to Egypt and Africa and other places. We were talking a little bit about Jesus, and without going deeply into Christianity or Jesus' life, there's a period of time known as the lost years for Jesus, between the time he was born and a young man and his reemergence in his 30s. And the question is, where was he during that lost time? And there are some who have researched and some who have speculated that he actually, too, went to India. What's your take on that?
Oh, Victor, you're going to be so disappointed with me.
Oh, no, go ahead.
I actually studied this in depth. I was going to write a book about this because this was really, really an exciting topic. But the more you look into it, the more complicated the picture gets. I actually believe that Jesus spent that time, as the Bible actually hints, in Egypt. Mm. Now, remember that teaching like that of India was available in Egypt, so it's possible that he was exposed to it there. Here is the most important point. There is another figure in the Bible, my favorite figure in the Bible after Jesus himself, Doubting Thomas. And I really connect with Doubting Thomas because he couldn't believe it unless he saw it, and I'm the same. I need evidence. And both in India and in Greece, and in the Greco-Roman world, we have evidence that the disciple Thomas went to India. In fact, when I was in Kerala in South India, I visited some of the churches there that claimed to be in his tradition. They remember Thomas being in India, but they do not have a tradition of Jesus having been there. And that's why I'm a little bit nervous about this, because if we know for a fact that Thomas was there, then why wouldn't they have passed on that Jesus had been there too? Mm-hmm. But it was Jesus, according to the Christian literature, who sent Thomas to India. So clearly India was on his mind. And it is possible that he went to India. I would just like to see firmer evidence before I support that.
Absolutely. So getting back to the gist of Lost Masters, what you're basically saying is that the Greeks were really the first New Age thinkers.
Well, did you know that Alexander the Great had a guru? I mean, I've read numerous books on Alexander. I've watched, numerous, 4-part specials on Alexander on television, and they never mentioned that Alexander had a guru. And then you go back in the sources, and they all refer to this. This was a big deal to the Greeks. Virtually the first thing that Alexander did when he got to Egypt was send his men out to find one of these yogis that he'd been hearing so much about. The girl who finally went back with him to Persia was named Kalyana. But actually, if we have a minute, let me tell you about the first yogi that he met. It's a really famous story in the ancient Greek literature. So the Greeks made a yogi named Dunda, and so they gave him Alexander's message. Alexander, son of Zeus and sovereign of the entire earth, commands you to come at once. If he's pleased with you, he will reward you richly. If not, he will kill you. this is Alexander.
Made him an offer he couldn't refuse.
Exactly right. And so here's Dunda's answer. Now, it's all wonderful, but I'll just read part of it, because even though it's delightful, we don't have time. But here's what the message Dunda sent back to Alexander the Great. There is only one supreme king, the one who created light and life. This is the only king I obey, and he abhors war. Alexander can kill my body, but he cannot touch my soul. Tell your king that at the time of death, each of us is called to account for our deeds. Ask him how he's going to explain the agony of those he has murdered and oppressed. He can tempt those who crave gold. He can terrify those who fear death, but we yogis care for neither. Tell your Alexander he has nothing I want, and I will not come to him. And Alexander's response when he heard this is really, really famous. It's quoted in various ancient sources. So when Alexander heard what Dunda said, he said, I, the conqueror of the world, have just been conquered by a naked old man.
Ooh, wow.
Over and over again, the Greeks were just blown away, just galvanized by these yogis. For example, Kalyana, the master that Alexander finally persuaded to travel with him back towards Persia. And but by the time they reached, and Alexander was lavishing all kinds of wealth, all kinds of stuff on Kalyana. And Kalyana was just really disgusted, and it fed up with the Greeks. And, you know, Alexander, you know, he's homicidal. He's a huge mass killer, and he's an raving alcoholic and so on. And so maybe not the best student. But so Kalyana finally decided, you know, that he wanted to go back to India. But he didn't want to walk all that way because it was a really long walk back. So he built a fire, lit it, and sat down in the fire and burned his body up so that his soul could just return to India. And so the Greek troops are there watching Kalyana just sitting there in Samadhi in these high states, just calmly, you know, his body just disappearing in flames. And they couldn't believe that there was no fear, not even any apparent pain in this yogi. They were just galvanized by this. They couldn't believe it. And these stories about the yogis, they carried back with them to Greece. And now by Greece, I don't just mean what we call the country of Greece. No, I mean the whole Greek-speaking world in antiquity. So that would have included, you know, parts of Italy and Turkey and so on. But they were hearing about these yogis, and they were just amazed by them. But we have to remember that there were no shortage of spiritual masters in those cultures, too. It's just that their literature and their oral traditions have not survived.
Interesting. So this, the demonstration of self-immolation as a way of releasing the soul is pretty amazing to me. And how did the Greeks respond to that?
They were completely blown away. I mentioned Pero to you earlier. Pero was another one of the Greeks who lived in India. He lived there for about a year and a half. He's an important one for those who study Greek philosophy because he inaugurated a really important school that lasted for centuries in Greece. But what he was so impressed by the yogis and the Jains and the Buddhists also, was the level of detachment. I mean, there was compassion, there was love, there was wisdom, but there was also just a focus on what really mattered in life, on spirit. And so he began practicing that and took those practices back to Greece with him and founded a whole school because people were just so impressed by him.
Well, now, you touched upon this before, but let's start talking about a little bit more about this topic. You had mentioned that there were two of the great Greek philosophers who decried cruelty to animals and advocated vegetarianism. How did this come about?
Oh, there was more than two of them. But we're talking like about Plutarch and Porphyry. Most famous Greek philosophers were vegetarian. You know, Pythagoras, Plotinus, and so on. They felt, you know, that souls come back in bodies and that we need to respect all souls, you know, there's actually a really famous argument for vegetarianism by Plutarch that's still used today. He points out that, you know, animals, when they're hungry, carnivores will go and rip apart a living creature and gorge on it. When you're really hungry, do you visualize, you know, going out and sinking your teeth into a living being and ripping it to pieces and eating its raw flesh? You know, most humans don't, you know. They imagine, you know, he makes the point that if we truly were carnivores, then it would be deep, deep, deep in our psyche and in our spirit. So that the thought of just eating raw meat and killing animals with our bare hands and teeth, it would be part of our nature, but it's not. And so this was one of numbers of reasons why he was saying eating meat is unnatural for humans.
It's amazing that they would adopt that. I know that that part of the world, most of their diet was fish and meat. Is that correct?
Yes, that is. And so that's why it was exceptional for these Greek sages and their devotees to turn their backs on that. As well, you know, there's also a lot of drinking going on in this culture. And they also, most of them would not take alcohol. They were trying to be as clear as possible. And a balanced vegetarian diet promotes clarity of mind. And that's what they were aiming for, so that they could achieve these higher states of consciousness.
Did they also practice celibacy?
No, not necessarily. Pythagoras was married. He was a celibate for most of his life, actually, because in Egypt, to be a priest, you had to be celibate. And so Thales told him, you know, if you want to impress the priest there so that they'll accept you as their student, you have to be celibate. But like later in life, like in his 50s, he did marry. And in fact, his wife, Theano, was also recognized as a very great spiritual teacher. In fact, Iamblichus, one of the Greek masters from the 4th century, he gave us a list of the most illustrious Pythagoreans, and it includes the names of 17 women. So we've kind of forgotten, but there were also many great women spiritual teachers and women mystics in those days also.
Fascinating. My guest this evening, Linda Johnson, author of the new book, Lost Masters, Rediscovering the Mysticism of the Ancient Greek Philosophers. And we'll be back with Linda and more of this fascinating topic after these messages on the OM Times Radio Network.
As difficult as it is to believe, there are places in Africa where human traffickers sell albino children and their body parts for use in magic rituals. Humanity Healing International is actively working in Uganda to change this paradigm. The Albino Rescue Project finds albino children who are at risk and places them in safe schools and environments where they can learn and grow free from fear. To learn more or to sponsor a child, visit humanityhealing.org. Humanity Healing is where your heart is.
Circle of Hearts Radio is a sanctuary on the airwaves. Join me, Grandmother Alaya, in the circle on Sunday, 2 p.m. Eastern, as I share information to both enlighten and nourish your soul.
When Dad needed help getting around, I became his driver. Soon enough, it was up to me to be his housekeeper and financial manager, too. When he moved in, I became his cook and even his nurse. But no matter what roles I play, I know I'm still his daughter.
We understand the roles you play. So to help, we created aarp.org/caregiving, where you can connect with experts and other caregivers. Visit aarp.org/caregiving. Brought to you by AARP and the Ad Council.
Every Tuesday on Living with Moxie, join Shefali Burns and Donna Martuj in conversations designed to take you to the next level, where we highlight ideas, resources, and strategies that provide you with the leverage you require to meet and exceed your business and personal goals. Each week on Living with Moxie, we will lead conversations related to success, achievement, fulfillment, and extraordinary, vibrant living. Are you ready to live with Moxie? Join us.
Hope you enjoyed your meal.
And I just want to say, he's lucky to have a brother like you.
Lucky? Caring for my brother is far from easy. But he's a part of me, like my arms and legs, so I'll be his. No time for tired. Nothing can disable this love. He needs me, but I'm the lucky one, even though I need help now and then.
If you're caring for a loved one, visit aarp.org/caregiving for care guides and community. Support for your strength. Brought to you by AARP and the Ad Council.
And we're back on Destination Unlimited. My guest this evening, Linda Johnson, author of the new book, Lost Masters, Rediscovering the mysticism of the ancient Greek philosophers. Linda, we were talking about the meditation practice used by many of these Greek philosophers, and there's a form of practice called henosis that you talk about. What is henosis?
If any of the students listening to this have taken yoga classes, you may have studied a text called the Yoga Sutras, and it talks about samadhi, about these really, really deep states of meditative awareness. And there's an actual equivalent word in Greek, which Victor just shared, henosis. Hen is the Greek word meaning one. So henosis means the state of oneness. And this was what they were striving to attain through their self-discipline, through their rituals, and through their absolute commitment to spiritual life. By the way, scholars are fully aware of all this evidence that I've been mentioning here, but they're embarrassed by it, you know, that many of the founders of Western civilization were nowhere nearly as committed to materialism as academics are today. You know, the ancient Greeks were curious and open-minded, and so when we search intelligently for a deeper understanding of our own spiritual nature, we are not betraying the Western tradition, as my Jesuit professor in college was saying, we're actually just following in the footsteps of the founders of this tradition.
Absolutely. Let's talk a little bit about some of the other great Greek philosophers and how the Eastern influences and the Eastern teachings helped them to develop what they did. Let's talk about Democritus, for example. 2.5 millennia ago, he conceived the concept of the atom. Was he using thought practices gleaned from the East?
I actually don't think that that's as big a deal as people think, because in India, the Vaisheshika system, they had atomism. They already had the idea of the Paramanu, the smallest particle. And actually, their theories about atomism were far more sophisticated, as anyone who studied Vaisheshika will know. And probably there were similar theories in Persia and other countries. We just don't know anymore because all the material was lost. But one source does hint that Democritus visited India. So it's possible he may have been exposed to those ideas there. But the Greeks were brilliant, and they were spiritually enlivened, and they could have well have come upon these ideas themselves. So, if you're doing spiritual science, you'll uncover very similar truths. But it's amazing how prescient they were. You read the Stoics and their concept of world cycles and universes coming into being and passing out of being, into plasma and out of plasma. I mean, you think you're reading a modern text, scientific text today. These guys were brilliant.
Absolutely. Please share some examples of some other of Western philosophers inspired by Eastern practices.
Eckhart Tolle, I'm going to mention. I have to shout out to Eckhart. Those of you listening, maybe some of you have heard of him. He wrote this huge international bestseller some years ago called The Power of Now, and A New Earth. And I have to shout out to him because he was really excited by this material here. And he was the one who insisted that we republish this book and get it out there again because he wanted people to know about all this stuff. And he very graciously volunteered to write the introduction to the book. So thank you, Eckhart. You know, most of us have already heard of yoga and Sufism and Kabbalah, but what we don't know about is our own Western spiritual heritage. We don't even know that it existed. And I want people to know how exciting the Greek philosophers were and how amazing their lives were. So I told their, many stories about them in the book. And that they studied with wise men and women from older cultures, around them, Magi in Persia, Chaldeans in Iraq, as well as teachers in Egypt. And in some cases, they even studied in India. But people should know about, philosophers like Plato, Plotinus, Proclus, Hypatia, and the absolutely mind-blowing things that they were teaching in the Western world thousands of years ago. This is our spiritual heritage, folks.
So why has this information been obscured from us for so long?
numbers of reasons, some that I mentioned earlier, but also of the material that's survived, it's fallen into the hands, understandably, of academia. And when scholars write about it, they translate it for other scholars. So, like, if I read a text like the Aeneids by Plotinus and say, oh my gosh, this is the most spiritually enlivening thing that I've ever read, and then my friends pick up and try to read, they can't even get through 2 pages because there's so much scholarly gobbledygook and jargon, and they can't understand what it's saying. Now, I love all that stuff. You know, it's just juice to me. I'm fine with that. But I thought, you know, what I need to do is to then put this stuff into plain English. More writers need to do this who know the tradition. Go back and put this in plain English so that people can learn about our tradition. You know, I also wanted to tell people about the Corpus Hermetica, which were the absolutely astonishing ancient texts which meld the ancient Greek and Egyptian wisdom traditions together.
Yes.
Of everything available in the Western world, my favorite spiritual text by far. When they were rediscovered in 1460, I think it was 1460, they helped spark the European Renaissance.
Absolutely, sure.
And it will blow your mind to see how close they are to the teachings of India. There was a world tradition at one time, I believe, of spirituality across cultures, where they were teaching and practicing similar things, even having the same conflicts and arguments. For example, there's Porphyry and Plotinus who feel that rituals are kind of useless. What you really need to do is plunge within, and contact your spirit within directly. And then you have teachers like Iamblichus saying, no, wait a minute. We also want to completely transform our personalities and make this live in our lives. And for that, we have to do rituals and ritual practices and ritual magic and contact the deities, the intelligences that exist behind nature. And so they're having the same argument that they were having in India, you know, in between like the Jnana yogis or the yogis who just believe in diving within into pure consciousness, and some of the tantrics who believe in doing ritual practices. So this was not a one-size-fit-all tradition like the religion that I was raised in. There was something for everyone. You know, if you're into rituals, you know, you absolutely should read the chapter in Iamblichus. He is giving really good advice for people who are interested in channeling or contacting discarnate entities.
Wow.
whether you think of them as actually real or as projections of the unconscious. But according to him, some of these entities or energies, if you want to call them, they're benign, but others are definitely not. And he explains how to tell the difference. He also warns how a spiritual practice can shade over into sorcery when your ego gets involved. So, I mean, there are just all kinds of really practical concerns and amazing insights that I think a lot of people today would really benefit from knowing about.
Let's touch upon the Corpus Hermeticum for a second, because you brought up a very interesting point. You have Hermes Trismegistus, who is Hermes, the Greek god, the messenger of the gods. You have Thoth or Tahuti, who's the Egyptian counterpart of Hermes Trismegistus.
Right. What,
who is the Hindu counterpart of those two?
This is a very complex thing. Hermes, in part, is represented by a figure named Narada in the Hindu tradition. But in the Hindu tradition, they would be explaining what this is actually is a D-H-I in Sanskrit. It's the highest intelligence within yourself. It's your highest intuitive power. And we give it this name, but it's really a part of our own being, which, according to both the Hindus and the Greeks, or many of the Greeks, is also a part of the universe itself. In India, the Mahat, the cosmic mind, is a part of their cosmology. To the ancient Greeks, the Anima Munda, the cosmic mind, was part of their understanding. And our bodies and our minds and our highest intuitive states are not separate from the universe. We're part of the universe. We're a reflection of the universe.
What Emerson called the oversoul.
Oh, you've got it exactly. Yeah. And this was all just a huge part of the Western wisdom tradition originally, and we should reclaim our tradition.
I think we have to. In fact, that was leading to my next question. Lost Masters Rediscovering the Mysticism of the Ancient Greek Philosophers. It's the time for this, isn't it, in our
yes,
world today?
It is. With all respect to Christianity, my own religion, and to the other religions that are practiced in the Western world, but there's a hunger that those traditions do not fulfill. And so what do people do? Well, people are just, getting stoned, watching TV, doing extreme sports, anything to fill that sense of emptiness and meaninglessness. And if people are destroying their lives with overuse of drugs, or doing these other crazy self-destructive things, I actually blame religion. Because when people are connected to themselves, this doesn't happen. This is what your hero Pythagoras said. People destroy themselves when they're disconnected from their own inner being. They know something's wrong. They know something's missing, and you can't. There's nothing else can fill it but your own spiritual essence. It's what makes you come alive. It's getting to know yourself.
Absolute truth. My guest this evening, Linda Johnson. Her new book, Lost Masters Rediscovering the Mysticism of the Ancient Greek Philosophers. Linda, please tell our listeners one more time where they can get your book and find out more about you and this amazing work.
Go to Amazon.com, go to BarnesandNoble.com, go to your local
bookstores.
Or check out, my website, LostMasters.com. That's LostMasters.com.
Linda, thank you so much for joining us. This is a fascinating read, and I think this is the message that we need in our world today.
Thank you so much, Victor.
And thank you all for joining us on Destination Unlimited. I'm Victor the Voice Furman. Have a wonderful week. See you next week. Good night now.